I may be a slut, but at least I'm an honest slut. So find someone else to put the starch in your pants.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This is episode 3 of season 2 of Queer as Folk, and it's called Hypocrisy. Don't do it.
It first aired in the U.S. on January 20th, 2002.
It was directed by Michael DiCarlo, who directed 11 episodes of Queer as Folk. This is his fifth. Most recently, he directed 2 episodes of the very underrated TV show Rogue.
What is Rogue?
It's a Canadian show.
That's why I haven't heard of it.
Yeah.
Hypocrisy, Don't Do It was written by showrunners Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman with Karen Walton, who also wrote the teleplay. She went on to write 4 episodes of Orphan Black and also produced 20 episodes of it.
The Showtime synopsis is as follows. Ted's favorite author, Howard Bellwether, protests Brian's Hero Award while collecting his own. Emmett works for men who are similar to the politically correct characters of the fabulous new gay TV drama Gay as Blazes. And Michael wants to reconnect with Brian in a comic book convention.
The IMDb synopsis. Brian wins an award for saving Justin, despite a scathing editorial from a gay columnist. Michael wants to reestablish his friendship with Brian.
That's weak.
Skimp. That skims on a lot of what goes on in this episode.
This show opened with a kind of a funny parody of itself. With a diversity correct scene from Gay as Blazes. There is a white man, a black man, an Asian Latino, and a disabled man all having dinner.
To Judge Bruce
and Dr. Bobby,
congratulations!
10 years of fidelity.
Happy anniversary.
Where's Jamie?
He said he's stuck in surgery.
I'm sure he's operating. With some boy.
Club Sodom.
That awful place. Where they dance and take drugs
and have sex.
So I've heard. It's a shame Jamie's allowed himself to become a stereotype instead of a role model for the community.
Right.
Hopefully one day he'll come to his senses and realize that his time could be spent in so many more productive ways.
Like exactly, joining our gay men's reading group.
Yes.
Last week we read Sylvia Plath. Oh.
And this week, Jane Austen. Mm.
Everyone is watching this at Woody's. The show is just parodying itself because bars used to host Queer as Folk viewing parties. I must admit that I attended a few in Chicago.
Was it at Sidetrack?
It was.
Nailed it.
So this was really funny. At first, I was watching this episode thinking, what in the world is going on and why is this here? Michael had a really scathing line where he said, well, let's listen to it real quick.
The whole point of GAB is that it's not all about sex. There's more to gay life than that.
But let's remember, though, that Michael's very first line in the show was,
the thing you need to know is, it's all about sex. It's true.
So he literally contradicted himself by saying that Gay as Blazes isn't all about sex.
Well, now, let me ask you, Patrick, what do you think might have caused that change in his perception?
I don't know, Matt. Season 2 renewal?
Let's look at the event of season 1 that made him rethink who he was as a gay man. His relationship with Dr. David Cameron.
But he's been broken up for 2 episodes now.
Sure, and we did see him hook up in the first episode with some rando. But I think it is fair to assume or deduce from that moment that his relationship did have an effect on him that made him reassess who he is as a gay man, because that was probably his first legitimate long-term relationship. I mean, he went off.
Yeah, it was.
So for me, it stands to reason that that could make Michael change his position on what it means to be a gay man, especially also that he is now 30. He's no longer in his 20s. It stands to reason that he may view things differently now.
I don't think he got laid in this episode, did he?
Not in this episode, but
it was
past episode 1
of season 2. I don't think he got any action in 2, did he?
Yes. Remember he got the most amazing blowjob?
Oh, that's right. To me, that makes this even a little more out of place for Michael to be saying those lines. I thought
when you mentioned that, yes, it is, then it's a little like odd. But I mean, he was also kind of going through his mourning period.
I thought that this intro was a little bit of the show defending itself, because at the time there was an awful lot of press about how Queer as Folk was not realistic at all. At first airing on Showtime, they used to run a disclaimer that said, "Queer as Folk is a celebration of the lives and passions of a group of gay friends. It is not meant to reflect all of gay society."
Okay, let's go ahead and break that down, because I did not know that that was a thing.
They're almost saying, we're not really this gay, but...
It's like, this is a gay show, but in no way does it reflect the opinions of the gay community. That's what it feels like. Let's be honest, there are different kinds of gay people. That's an okay thing.
I thought there were an awful lot of bitchy gay people at the time that were complaining about the show and thinking that it had to exactly relate to their life versus just being a drama or a comedy or a musical from time to time. It had to be accurate. It had to be documentary driven. And I think that's where a lot of that disclaimer came from. And there was a lot of press at the time too about people complaining, people don't have sex in clubs. It's like,
But actually, yeah. Let us gay-splain something to you.
Oh,
that in fact,
that's a good word.
That does. But also, I loved that the show was so blatant with it, because you could clearly see that the show is mocking itself by saying, like, yes, we're actually, in some ways, the complete opposite of what people want us to be.
Yeah.
And guess what? That's going to be our identity. Deal with it. So in some ways, I applaud that. I applaud that they're able to be who they want to be. Because guess what? There are a group of gay friends, and they're about making sure that they can live their full sexual life, and they can do that freely. That's something that really hasn't been seen on television before.
And it was a cross... I was going to say diverse, but it's not diverse. I think they're all white.
Yeah.
But they are all doing different things. You know, Brian is a high-powered ad executive. Ted used to be an accountant before he got caught jacking off at work.
As we will get into.
Michael works at what do you call that? A big box store. Emmett works retail. Melanie is a lawyer. Lindsay's an arts teacher. So there's a pretty big cross-section of gay people there. Again, they all happen to be white, but they are all in very different stations in life while this show is coming out. So this seems a little twofold at the time. The first was to kind of shut up complaints from gay people saying that the show wasn't realistic. And the second was to let straight people know that not all gay people act that way. Curiously, that played right into the title of this episode, which was Hypocrisy. Don't do it.
Yeah, the show kind of wants to be straight-laced, yet incredibly sexual. And I don't know, having that warning in front, and that's what it is. It's a warning. And I think that is highly unnecessary. And I think, you know, you look at gay shows now or queer-themed shows now, and they don't need to do that. They just need to say, guess what? Queer people exist.
Right before Queer as Folk started to air, the gay character on TV was really almost the muse. They were the over-the-top, flamboyant, or the closeted, but you knew darn well that the person was gay. So this really was kind of the first honest portrayal of gay culture, as Lindsay told us. That was quoted throughout the media at the time. I think that was a pull quote from like the New York Times or something like that. It just seemed at the time, though, that everybody wanted this show to be about themselves, and less about just letting people tell a story. This whole episode seemed to me to be about Brian 2.0. He seemed to be transitioning from Brian 1.0, the villain, to a certain level of respectability. Early on, we find out that the Gay and Lesbian Center wants to honor Brian with a hero award, and he seems to entirely care less about it. The biggest comedy part of that little section was when Lindsay literally grabbed Brian by the balls.
She already got what she needed from his balls. I don't really know why she was grabbing them.
I just thought that was weird. She just goes for it. Seeing Brian being less of this villain, and I messaged you about that over the weekend when we were prepping for the show, because I accused you of thinking that he was the villain of season one.
And which I wasn't shy about it. I think he is definitely antagonistic in the series.
Yeah. Here we start to see him kind of soften up a little and be a little more human. They still keep some edge around him, but we see him doing things that we never really would have seen Brian doing in season one. So there's a big transformation of Brian here. And so I think that's our A story that goes on through this episode of reinventing Brian, if you will. There was this funny scene where that awards committee showed up at Melanie and Lindsay's house while they're going at it on the sofa with the vibrator. This reminded me again that this show was a long time ago. People just show up at your house to tell you something. They don't phone, they don't text, they don't email. They just come knock.
They come and knock on our door. And what amazed me about this scene is like I'm making the presumption that that is a gay man and a gay woman who is on the committee. Is that a fair assumption?
Oh, yeah. Tanis and I can't think of the guy's name. I didn't write it down.
Why were they surprised that a vibrator was in the vicinity of this home?
Yeah, Tanis was horrified by it. I can see the gay man being a little like, yikes. But Tanis should have been like, eh, yeah, here, take
be
this.
Like, oh, sorry about that. Like, come on.
Do you hear a buzzing?
Oh, no, I have the baby monitors on the fence.
Sounds like it's coming from...
Oh! Oh.
Something that I actually enjoy about this show is that they don't apologize for all these characters of having a very vibrant sex life. See what I did there? And... And I think this is something that will happen as we continue on throughout the episode. But for them, for these committee members to be shocked and horrified that this married couple was trying to have sex in their home when they were interrupted, it just boggled my mind.
I could see being a little horrified if you sat down on somebody else's dildo and it was like still warm and a little gooey. I can see her reaction there, but maybe that was it because it did land in Tanis's lap and then she threw it over into the other guy's hands and they both shrieked.
The other thing is the fact that Mel tried to cover up what it was.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's, I was like, Mel.
Tanis, whoever was playing Tanis, I didn't write down the actor's name. She gave this great little eye roll as soon as Melanie is putting the device into the plant.
The device.
For the device. Lindsay did say something really strange here about the article. They read the article from Howard Bellwether. That's why Tanis and the gay
the other one
were over there. And Lindsay says,
"This is a completely unfair and dishonest attack. Justin Taylor is a college student. Their relationship is legal, consensual, and very loving."
So I bumped on this one. Justin started college already, I guess?
Well, where that left us off was that he wasn't going to go to college. Because you're in season one, he was going back and forth. He didn't know if he was going to go to art school or he didn't know if he was going to be like a legacy at whatever.
Yeah, he decided to go to art school, but then he got bashed at his prom. So all of a sudden, well, I guess if he graduates, he's technically a college student, even if he didn't start college yet.
I don't know. Like that is an odd, I mean, maybe she's using college student to describe his age more. Like he's no longer a high school student.
This is also the first time that somebody referred to Brian and Justin as very loving. So I thought that came out of the blue. I don't know why that line hit me so much. It just seemed like a very big fast forward. We were supposed to realize that Justin and Brian are in a consensual, loving, legal relationship. Nobody else describes it that way. That's why I tripped up on that one.
Agreed. But I think it is more about recognizing Brian's behavior as of late since the bashing and how he had put forth such an effort to help Justin in his recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the point of view that Lindsay's trying to spin on it so that the committee isn't recognizing Brian as just some sort of sexual deviant who went after an underage kid.
You might be right because there's another cute scene where Justin is walking down the street and Brian's at the other end of the street, kind of holding his arms out, waiting for him to be able to navigate through a crowd of people, which, by the way, we'd never seen Liberty Avenue that crowded before.
Was it Pride weekend? What happened?
Pride's next weekend. That's the next episode, actually.
Aha. Uh-huh. So it's the pregame. It's the Pride Fest to the Pride parade.
It was cute to see them holding hands and walking down the street. Once again, though, Brian's doing more of this amateur PTSD therapy with Justin, which I never liked that, but I did like that we had this cuteness.
I guess it then serves Lindsay's point again that this is actually more loving than people would believe. But I definitely agree with you that Justin should still be seeing some sort of professional.
Yeah, this needs professional clinical assistance, possibly medication. There was a nice song playing underneath this when Justin was soloing down the street. It was called When My Boy Walks Down the Street by the Magnetic Fields. Brian said something that totally creeped me out here, though. Justin's maybe 20 feet away. He's threading through all the crowd. People are bumping into him. You can tell that he's like scared and nervous. Brian says,
"Come on, Sonny Boy."
And I just kind of went, "Ooh, Sonny Boy." That's what Brian's father used to call him and what Brian calls Gus. Why is he calling Justin Sonny Boy here?
Now that you bring it up, that is odd.
Yeah.
That redefines what their relationship would be, so that it is more paternal than consensual love. And that's, now it's just weird.
Sunshine would have been better.
Absolutely.
Because Brian has only used that once or twice. And that's more of a term of affection. Sonny Boy is more, like you said, the paternalistic sounding.
I'm going to blame Karen Walton for that.
Yeah. It was a cute scene. That line just really made me wonder where they were going with Brian 2.0, though.
Yeah, that doesn't help track what they're trying to set up in terms of the overall arc of their relationship.
Another funny episode here that I'll chalk up to weak writing was the what I labeled the lesbian restaurant. So Mel and Lindsay are preparing a very elaborate multi-course meal for Brian. This was just so corny, though. They are bringing out fine wine, like a 18-ounce steak, all kinds of stuff like that, and a cigar. By the way, Brian's allowed to smoke a cigar in the house with the baby there. So
I mean, maybe Gus was up in his room, but this is a wonderful point to bring up in that if we know that Brian didn't really care about getting the award, and then they went through all of this effort to try and say, you have to show up for them to be like doing all these things to build up to ask him, actually, can you not accept the award?
Yeah.
They probably could have left well enough alone and he probably would have blown it off anyway.
Yeah, totally. Because if we know anything about Brian, it's that he's not going to go to the gay and lesbian center and be honored as a gay hero. That's just not in his DNA. His DNA is, I am me, not I am me, gay man.
Right. And I think that really speaks to the timeliness of this episode, which we can get into when we do our scorecards. But there is, on one hand, such a need to make sure that there are the gay heroes that people can look up to. But then I think there's also, and I see this all the time on Facebook because I like the Human Rights Campaign on Facebook. Like, I liked their page. I see all these videos of people like Visionary Award, like all these like titles that we give people to say, these are the heroes you should be looking up to. And I see kind of the same type of people.
What type?
It is traditionally attractive, oftentimes male, on the rare occasion female.
What are they famous for?
They could be an athlete, they could be an actor, you know, things like that. But
they could be gay.
Yeah, as long as they're gay. Well, it's not like that. We love
that's the only qualification.
We also love the gay community, as well, at least the Human Rights Campaign I noticed, loves to give awards to allies. I'm all for allies. I am happy there are people who will always stand up for the gay community who aren't gay themselves, but recognize us just human beings. But that's the other thing. Sometimes I have an issue with, I feel like we're just having to give awards to people for not being shitty.
It's almost like those 40 under 40 types of things in business magazines.
Seriously.
I think it just comes down to journalism for journalism's sake, mm-hmm, and less about somebody doing something super extraordinary. In lineups like those, I tend to find like maybe one or two people in there that I really was interested in reading about, but then the other like 38 out of there are like, meh, who cares?
Right. The one I will always defend, even though I have issues with the overall aspect of the whole ally award business, I will go to that mat for Audra McDonald, because she will call out every stupid, shitty, homophobic person on Twitter, and she can tout away and let them know what she thinks while holding her six Tonys, and she's amazing.
Six Tonys.
So thank you, Audra McDonald.
Of course, we know that Brian isn't going to be at this banquet. to accept the award. And something funny that I noticed about this banquet was it was very well attended.
Yeah.
They really spent a lot on the extras and the set dressing there, which if we remember from last season when Brian won that award as best ad exec or whatever, there was like 15 people there. This one was like a proper banquet.
Was it in the same banquet hall? I would have loved to have thought that Brian was just fucking like
the
nondescript gay dude who didn't want him to get the award up in the balcony.
It might have been.
That would have been amazing.
I did like how the only table that went absolutely batshit crazy when Brian's award was announced was our table. Nobody else did anything.
Because they were all about Howard Bellwether.
Lindsay says that Brian got his message across loud and clear, which was that I think the hypocrisy of giving Howard Bellwether an award needed to be noted. And by Brian forcing them to give him the award, but then just not showing up for it, really drove home that hypocrisy theme there. We'll talk about that little section in a little bit.
Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
The B story that I ID'd here was Michael being stuck in the past, but clawing for the future. This comic book theme has always struck me as weird for two gay characters.
Why is that?
Do you know any, well, I was about to say, do you know any gay guys that are really into comic books? And then I'm like thinking, I dated one for a while. he did dump me with a text message though, so.
Ugh.
Yeah, I still have a copy of that text message and a screenshot.
Ew.
I don't know. It just seemed like a really weird subgenre to base an entire two characters of the show around. I think it draws back towards what Russell T. Davies did with the UK Queer as Folk, where they were Doctor Who fans. Doctor Who was very much what English boys grew up watching. So I think they needed a parallel here, because young gay boys in America aren't going to know who Doctor Who is. So let's give them comic books instead.
I don't think it's that strange, because we see the way comic book characters are used as representatives of outsiders or the other. Like, that's the whole point of comic book characters. Like, look at the X-Men. They've always been to be those kinds of characters. They represent those who are on the fringe of society. So it makes sense that there would be those who might be closeted gay kids who latch onto those kinds of stories because they see so much of themselves in those characters.
That comes out a lot more later in the series. But do you think that Cohen and Lippman really thought up like something that deep about let's use comic books as the link between Michael and Brian?
Sure.
It just seems weak to me.
I mean, hell, what do people think about Batman and Robin's relationships? Everyone fills that with some sort of homoerotic undertones. And it doesn't surprise me.
Maybe when we think about it now in 2018, it's a little bit more of a stretch because young gay boys are latching onto like Drag Race, for example. There's legitimate gay characters that can be a little comic booky. They can be a little over the top, but it's not like straight people that they are trying to associate some kind of a connection with.
There are also now gay superheroes. So
none? I don't know. You're looking at me like, Patrick, come on. I have no idea.
I'm gonna leave the research to you. But yes, there are superheroes that are written today in comic books today that are also out or have explored their sexuality beyond just the typical heterosexual tendencies. So
who are some of these people? I know nothing of this. Oh, God, that guy that I dated probably dumped me for a reason like this.
He's going to be listening and you're going to get a text from him going like, this is why.
He actually dumped me because somebody in San Francisco proposed to him and said, hey, come marry me. And he said, okay, quit his job, moved to San Francisco.
Wow.
Yeah, that didn't last. They didn't get married and he's back in Chicago now.
Cough.
Yeah. I'll show you a picture off air in a few minutes. Brian did some uniform play with a cop in the back of the van.
Oh, my God. Let's talk about that scene for a second.
Well, first, was that a real cop or was that cosplay for the cop going to the comic book con?
Didn't he have like a police vehicle?
Yeah, but I can see people showing up at a con and like a Batmobile or something. But
isn't there like a point where it's like
illegal.
Yeah, to impersonate a police officer. Is that a thing?
Okay, so we're going to assume he was a real policeman then. It wasn't cosplay.
Sure. It was about to use his baton in a very interesting way.
Yeah, that fixation on the baton lingered for many seconds. Brian's like licking it and he's admiring it. He's gently stroking it. He's using it as a probe of sorts.
It stands in for his dick. Let's just call it what it is.
Why didn't he use his dick then?
Oh, I'm pretty sure he did, but he was probably enjoying the power play that was happening.
He did have the cop handcuffed.
Exactly. He must have been talking to Dale Wexler.
Oh, yeah. So we get the return of the three-way call, which we love. I love how many different directors and Queer as Folk use this technique. In this three-way call, Ted is jacking off, Michael is at the big queue, and Emmett is ironing outside on the porch. And they're talking about how Brian didn't show up at the con. And Emmett's talking about how the Gay as Blazes lookalikes that he is not naked made for. I did like that porch, though.
It was really nice.
It looked very idyllic. Emmett's just there ironing on the back porch, and there's all green shrubs behind it and woods. I was like, oh, that's like a nice summer. Yeah. So we did find out that Brian had stood up Michael for Comic-Con there. And then to tie this scene together, Michael's at the diner commiserating with his mother, Debbie. Debbie said this funny line that, again, I bumped on this one. So let's talk about this line here for a minute.
Why must your happiness always depend on someone else? First Brian, then David, now back to Brian.
You finished?
I haven't even started.
I didn't quite get that line, though, because Michael's happiness didn't exactly depend on Dr. David. In almost every episode of last season, he just kept bumping up against him because he seemed unhappy with the way that things were going. They went on the Paris trip, and then he was happy for a while, but then he became unhappy again. So I wasn't sure what Debbie meant by Michael's happiness needing to depend on Dr. David. I could see kind of depending on Brian, but not so much with Dr. David. And I know you're a Dr. David fan, so I'm curious what you thought of that scene.
I think her point of view with that line is the way Michael went full force with Dr. David Cameron. Like, let's recall, in order for Michael to make, say, Dr. David Cameron happy, it was all about, like, allowing him to do all these things for him. So next thing you know, Michael has this really fancy car.
The gold Miata.
And he's hosting these parties. Yeah, he sort of went full force with it and put all of his eggs in one basket, in one of Dr. David Cameron's hefty basket. And he does the same behavior with Brian, and that he never can be truly happy because he latches himself onto him so tightly. Maybe that's what she's getting at.
Well, here's
that he's feigning this happiness because he latches himself on so tightly to these more dominant or alpha men.
Here's Debbie's next line.
If you came back here because you thought Brian was missing you as bad as you were missing him, you fucked up big time.
That's not why I came back.
He has a life of his own, which is more than I can say about you.
What did you make of that line? Because I never once got a whiff that was why Michael came back. He ended up in a new city with Dr. David. He knew only one person. So recreating his entire social structure would have taken time. With Dr. David dumping him, it doesn't seem like he would actually want to stay in a strange city that was never on his life's roadmap. It never seemed to me that him coming back was about Brian. It seemed more like the good doctor dumped him and he had no place to live.
My big issue is that they wrapped it up, the Dr. David Cameron storyline, so quote unquote neatly by giving it a sort of bland explanation for them breaking up and Michael moving back. So for Debbie to come up with this is sort of them trying to like make up for lost or making up ground that they didn't really cover in the first place. We had spent the first season invested in the trials and tribulations of this relationship, so that to see that it didn't, to for us to not even see it end. Like, yeah, we're not given a lot of detail, a lot of things to actually be supported in, like, the text that they wrote or that they shown for us, for Debbie to come up with something like that.
Yeah, other than Debbie dropping the clues that Brian probably really does love Justin. This scene just didn't resonate much with me, partially because having a mother yell at somebody is something that for me is still fingernails on the chalkboard. But I just didn't quite get this scene. It was almost like this scene was written based on something else that had happened that we just never found out about.
It was like something that showed up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
And they thought, no one will care.
Here's some footage. Let's use this. A little while later, Debbie and Vic show up at Woody's. We get that familiar eye roll from Michael when his mother walks into the bar, but isn't he used to this by now?
She works at the gay diner.
Yeah.
I mean, dude, come the fuck on.
I could see how I wouldn't like to run into my mother at every gay bar, considering things that I do at gay bars.
So it's fine.
That's an interesting point. Has she ever been to Babylon?
We haven't seen that yet.
I can't think of an episode where she's been to Babylon. No, she did. To get bail money for Vic when he got arrested for wanking off in the in the toilet.
Well, there she wasn't there for fun. She was there right. Because she knew where they would be. She only sought out. She's not there to dance on the cages.
Yeah, all we need is Russell Mulcahy to just cue the music, and here goes Debbie, who whips off her wig.
Yes!
And gets
it. I'd be into it.
That tees up another funny part of Ted and Michael heading to the BB party.
Well, I did see an invitation on hotpits.com to a BB party. I thought you swore off the internet. There's a site I forgot to delete.
A BB party?
Stands for bodybuilders. Mm.
The bodybuilder? Fucking really?
I liked how this scene was dropped in because it's another breadcrumb showing us that Michael is totally lost and really doesn't know what he's doing. So he'll do anything. He'll go anywhere. The party was entirely all red lighting, and there's a huge orgy going on all over the furniture, all over the kitchen, on the floor, everything. It seems like this was a curious scene when looking at it through today's lens, though. Well,
I'm sorry. I still can't get over the fact that both Ted and Michael think they're going to a bodybuilding party, that it's some sort of fetish party for people who are into muscles.
I could see that. I would go to that party. Was BB at the time, was that like common lingo for something? I'd never heard that.
I would have thought, but maybe I don't know enough about how...
We don't know, like, early 2000s slang.
Like the written advertisements. I'm actually kind of curious to Google, like, when did that kind of terminology really come into prominence within the community? Because I would have thought, at least with Ted, considering how much porn he watches, he would have figured out that BB means bareback.
Yeah, this is something that I bumped on too, which is nowadays it seems like everybody barebacks, even those not even on prep. Which even then isn't guaranteed anyway, to say nothing of the dramatic increase in things other than HIV of people on PrEP.
Right, because let's remember that PrEP is meant to...
Lower the risk.
It is not a full-on replacement for condom use.
Yeah. So in 2001 and 2002, barebacking was a huge deal. It was much more of a forbidden fruit type of thing. If you knew somebody that was doing it, they were just in an entirely different class of gaydom. If you knew, like, oh yeah, he's a big barebacker. I kid you not, in 2001, 2002, that was a real thing.
I was in seventh grade, so.
Well, something you might have learned of in seventh grade was Cobra Video, which made millions off of being one of the first gay porn companies to do almost all bareback porn with twinks and twunks. That was like where Brent Corrigan became a superstar barebacking on camera when he was 17.
Speaking of Brent Corrigan, have you ever watched the movie King Cobra?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
God, that's terrible. I just have to say it.
Yeah. You know, it had Christian Slater in it.
And James Franco.
James Franco and...
Garrett Clayton.
What was her name? The pretty in pink girl. Can't remember.
Oh,
her.
Molly Ringwald.
Yeah. I had high hopes going into that. As I watched it, I was struggling to pay attention to it. I was pretty familiar with that story. I'd written a blog post way back when Brian Kosis, the Cobra Video head, was first killed. That was probably the blog post that got the single largest amount of hits and traffic at the time. It was like well into like a million some page views. So I was really proud of it. And so I was pretty familiar with this story. Then I watched the movie and I was like,
It's terrible.
Yeah, it's like a movie of the week or It could be an after school special for gay boys.
Like literally an after school special.
So this barebacking party, the BB party, I think was a much bigger deal 17 years ago. You watch it now in 2018, you're just like,
Yeah,
there was one last weekend. What? Like,
I was at one 20 minutes ago. What are you talking about? No. What's so fascinating about this scene is that, you know, we're watching this orgy happening and Ted and Michael clue in on what BB actually means because they're like, something that's not the only thing missing.
Yeah, how did they do that? Because they didn't get close-ups.
Like, were they like literally in there to look?
That's not all that's wrong with this picture. Something's missing.
Hors d'oeuvres.
Condoms. No one's using condoms.
Including Howard Bellwether.
Holy shit, I don't think BB stands for bodybuilders. I think it stands for
barebacking.
There's Howard Bellwether going at it, and they did this.
He is topping bareback, probably about to drop a load in some guy's ass.
This great shot of where the camera was like mounted to the head of the bottom, looking backwards at Howard just in total bliss, pumping away.
Didn't Ted and Michael comment that the guys at the party weren't necessarily
bodybuilders?
Yeah.
We said that Howard Bellwether didn't have a very good body, but he wasn't bad.
Yeah. I wasn't mad about it. And the big thing to take away from that scene, though, is the very judgmental position, to use the phrase, that Ted and Michael place on the people at the party who are barebacking.
That used to be a thing. If you were known as the barebacker, you really had a different kind of reputation. It almost seems like if you want to use condoms, people are like, oh, no. Ugh. Or do you have any? No.
Like, on the one hand, I understand people have allergies. Like, people do have a latex allergy. Like, it's a legitimate thing because not everyone thinks about that. But then that's why you also make sure you are taking the proper precautions and you are talking to the person that you are about to have sex with. Because sex is always going to be an intimate act, no matter how abrupt it may occur.
How brief.
That's just depressing.
There was something interesting at Babylon with Michael and Brian. Michael finally comes right out and says that he didn't invite Brian to the Comic Con to look at comics or to relive their childhood. It was just about being together. So he's harking back to the way things were before Dr. David and before Justin, quote, got hurt. He calls them the dynamic duo. And
the ambiguously gay duo.
For the first time, I felt like Michael had realized that Brian was really moving forward in his life, but that he had done a hard reset after breaking up with Dr. David. It seemed like this midlife crisis for Michael where everything that he was accustomed to had suddenly changed and he tried to recapture it.
Yes, he very much wanted to go back to before, to use the phrase from Ragtime. And sorry about it, but Brian is moving forward. What are you expecting him to do? Should he end all of his things with Justin and have Michael continue to be the guy who has to wait in the Jeep so Brian can get his rocks off with some rando in the back room and then they go home?
Like, the good old days.
Right.
Debbie did say it best when she said that Brian's got a life and he's living his life. So she was kind of calling that out. I kind of felt bad for Michael here just because he was just missing something that he really wanted in his life. That hard reset that he did after coming back from Dr. David really did put him back to square one. He is really that Michael that we kind of first saw in episode one of the series when he was single, mm-hmm. before he'd even met the good doctor. Brian eventually does show up for the last 15 minutes of the Comic-Con. So I wondered why it was the last 15 minutes. Then I realized that Brian was recognizing Michael's nostalgia, but also showing that he's just not fully invested in that past the way that Michael would want him to be.
To where they are attached at the hip. That's just not going to happen anymore.
He did what was required of him. He recognized that his best friend had something that was important to him, but he wasn't going to go for like all 3 days of comic book overload.
Because also that's a lot.
Yeah. So that really ties up Michael for this episode. He didn't really move too far. He just goes on record with a lot of things that he misses, that he wants in his life. So this is teeing up some future storylines about Michael making some big changes in his life, especially what we'll call post-Dr. David, AD, after David.
That's good. We'll be right back. Have more to say about the episode? Like us on Facebook and join in on the discussion.
Still, Queer as Folk. Let's talk about Emmett as the gay maid, because I thought this little arc, or this little runner in the series was pretty funny.
It was adorable.
That oh-so-perfect gay couple.
hi.
Well,
I was like, that looked like the cushiest job. I would never leave it.
I love it when, I don't know if it was Blair or Blaine or whichever one it was. And by the way, their license plate said BB1 and BB2. I wonder if they went to the BB party.
Yeah.
When he first opens the door for Emmett and he just says, yes, in this kind of mid-Atlantic accent.
So affected. So affected.
Yeah. At first, I couldn't tell if these were the same actors playing the Gay as Blazes characters or not. They were different.
Oh, they were different, but different obviously actors. Very clear choice to mimic what Emmett has been experiencing on TV, because he's really invested in all the characters on Gay as Blazes.
The Oh So Perfect gay couple just cracked me up, because I don't know if you ever run into a couple like that where they are just annoyingly perfect.
Yep.
It's like, it's Blair's night to read to the visually impaired gay seniors group. Show me to the designer kitchen. Lawyer, dentist, I think they were. Drives me crazy. Ugh. There's that great POV shot from Blair's cock as Emmett picks up the towel.
Right, because they when Emmett first started at this job, we get the whole explanation that, oh, they don't expect him to be naked.
So, where would you like me to start?
Wait!
What? I'm a naked maid, didn't they tell you, the agency?
Yes, but that won't be necessary. You see, even though some members of our community find it titillating to sexualize even domestic work, we prefer you keep your pants on. We'll pay you the same fee, of course. It's just our small way of bringing a little dignity to our community.
They don't live that kind of lifestyle the way other gays do. Mm-hmm. But then Blair comes out looking very good and just, oops, drops his towel.
He had the mid-Atlantic accent, too.
Emmett gets on his knees to help pick up the towel.
That shot goes all the way down Emmett's throat. The camera
the
goes.
Only thing that went down Emmett's throat. Let's be honest.
And then Blaine? Which one is which?
I don't know.
The other
it
one
matter.
Is in the kitchen where Emmett is cooking dinner and spills sauce on his crotch. So Emmett starts to wipe it off. And episode number two goes down. So Emmett thinks that he ruined 11 years of monogamy. But despite what Blaine and Blair said in the establishing scene, it wasn't too much of a leap to see that they had done this before.
Yes, they're very clearly into the cuckolding fantasy, which is a legitimate sexual fantasy. I like that they come clean about it.
Yeah, eventually.
But I don't really understand the line where Emmett, because they ask Emmett to stay on and they start to seduce him and he's very into it. And then he breaks away and he says,
I may be a slut, but at least I'm an honest slut. So find someone else to put the starch in your pants.
And I found that a little judgmental on Emmett's part.
I thought it was great.
I can understand him not wanting to be in, let's say, an unwitting partner in the fantasy, like not realizing that he's being taken apart of the fantasy. But that's kind of what helps sell the fantasy for the other couple. And I would like to think that the actions between each person in the action was consensual. Emmett is absolutely free in his right to say no. And I like that he makes it clear, but he could have also said, I'm actually unable to do that, rather than spinning his judgment on it.
Well, I don't think he liked being lied to about it and being put through that emotional wringer of thinking that he had ruined a relationship, because he was blaming himself the whole time.
Sure. But what I'm saying is, like, now that he has the information that this is part of a fantasy,
just dive in.
Well, not that he should just dive in, but that he can say, oh, I see what you're doing. You know what? That's not for me. And that's fine. But don't yuck someone else's yum. That's what I'm getting at here.
Michael finally said something wise when they were walking down the street.
Well, 1 minute I'm starching his collar. The next minute I'm sucking his cock. Single-handedly, I've destroyed 11 years of fidelity. That's what I've done. I'm scum. No, I'm worse than scum. What's worse than scum?
We've all been around long enough to know that nobody does anything they don't want to do. This Blair sounds like no angel.
Well, he was. Now he's fallen. Oh, I'm the snake in the Garden of Eden.
Stop.
That's what I am.
Stop blaming yourself. No, start blaming yourself. You know, it wouldn't have happened if you could keep your mind off of sex long enough to think about something else.
He called out the Blaine and Blair trio. Duo? I guess they're a duo at this
point.
They're
a duo, yeah, two.
He called them out on this. I thought that was interesting because throughout the series, we've always seen Michael as just the buffoon, but he had some good lines there. He had some wisdom. I did like the Gay as Blazes reenactment of Emmett's resignation scene where they have the like an Emmett lookalike with long flowing surfer hair. It was a little bit of a throwaway ending to the episode.
You don't have to be out on the streets anymore, Travis.
From now on, you're going to be living here with us.
You're so kind. I didn't know gay people like you existed.
We're not all sexual predators.
In fact, the only thing we like bound in leather is a good 19th century novel.
Have you read Jane Austen?
Oh.
It's better than sex.
Wow.
Blaze this.
He was really calling out more hypocrisy there. So this little storyline was a lightweight version of hypocrisy. That's really all it was there
don't
for.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. Howard Bellwether.
This son of a bitch.
Ted's speech about being validated by Howard Bellwether was funny when he's waiting to get his book signed.
Mr. Bellwether, I am so, so validated by what you write. You are a font of inspiration and wisdom.
A font. How kind.
Because Howard Bellwether is just licking up the praise. He wants it all. Ted thinks that he's making a personal connection, and Howard's just like, worship me.
It's, ugh.
I did like how Justin, who must be over his PTSD, because he just storms into the book signing and throws the books around.
Because Howard Bellwether invalidates everything that Justin has been feeling for the past season and two episodes. And go fuck yourself, Howard Bellwether. You know nothing of what the relationship is that they built together.
As a generic story, what did you think of Howard Bellwether's description of somebody stealing somebody's youth?
I don't buy it, and I will tell you. I'll tell you that my issue with Howard Bellwether trying to discern what the relationship was and giving such a negative spin on it is that he's effectively blaming Brian for Justin's gay bashing, and that's, I think, an incredibly unfair thing. He stood there as a protector for Justin to allow him to be himself at his own prom. That's a huge step forward for gay rights. And it also, well, it did have the unfortunate event of having Chris Hobbs be shown as a homophobic assaulter. What was leading up to it was done without malice.
I think it was a little bit deeper there. I think Howard's point was that when an older man of 30 is with that 17-year-old first time out on Liberty Avenue twink, that he can't help but think that some of that is stolen from Justin. It's almost like taking a shortcut. Like Justin these days would have a lot more relationships with his classmates or people closer to his age, not necessarily going directly to 29, 30-year-old Brian Kinney. So
29 at the time, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was Howard's attempt to be sanctimonious, as Ted called him later.
That's not a positive quality, to be sanctimonious. To me, that tells me that you are being holier than thou.
Yeah, which is what Cohen and Lippman and what's her name?
Karen Walton
wanted us to think about Howard Bellwether, but it did have kind of these morsels of truth in it because Justin was forced to grow up like very quickly in 1 year of his life. You know, he went from being like 17-year-old, I like watching Tomb Raider and Tylenol makes me sick, to being a fully functional member of the team doing shots and winning the King of Babylon contest. You know, his acceleration to escape velocity from childhood was astronomical in just that first season, where I think Howard's point was, if he didn't have that experience, it would have been a much slower ride, and he would have been able to figure out some of these things with a little less hurt.
Everyone has a different journey. And I think that's the point that also Cowan and Lemon are trying to make. No one's going to be this pristine, perfect example of the community. Like, even in, we've discovered, like, Howard Bellwether, who people think is just the pinnacle of the perfect gay man, is kind of a seedy character too. But then he touts himself to be this,
the gay social conscience of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and it's disgusting.
Did you see that weird little moment where Brian grabs Ted's ass on the way out of the book signing?
No. How did I miss this?
So Brian leans forward and has his pithy little line, "I'm 30, because Howard Bellwether had accused him of being like 31 or something. And he grabs and twists Ted's butt really hard on the way out. And Ted just kind of goes, he didn't know what that was there for. At Babylon, after this book signing, Ted is just furious that he'd spent the money on the book. Howard had earlier called out Brian's promiscuity, so Ted was seeing him as a bit of a hypocrite. Within the same conversation, Emmett is talking about being promiscuous with Blaine and Blair. So Emmett was being hypocritical too, because he said that he wasn't going to do it anymore, but he did. Ted gives Emmett a pass though, and later Emmett comes right out and says that, yes, he's a slut, but he's honest about it, not hypocritical. So this hypocrisy theme just keeps weaving in and out and back and forth here. At the award show, Ted had an interesting line about Howard Bellwether after he got his award.
Still believe in what he says. Even if I don't believe in him.
That I found really interesting to hear in 2018, where we're having to ask the question of if we can still enjoy the art but loathe the artist.
It's very true.
Like, for example, is the art of House of Cards to be put in a drawer because we can't stand Kevin Spacey? Or can we still watch the show? You know, how do you separate the two? Because for now, the answer seems to be that we have to hate both of them at the same time.
See, I don't hate House of Cards because I always found Robin Wright to be the true star of the show. Mm. And so now that they're going to continue on to at least wrap up the show without Kevin Spacey and focus on the true star of the damn show, Robin Wright, that I can still watch House of Cards because they're rectifying the situation and how they're going to wrap up the series. Kevin Spacey is not the only artist who's involved with that show.
True.
The writers, the directors, the crew.
They almost canceled the show, though.
They almost canceled the show, but they figured out a way to... It's sort of like how they regrouped. They like shut down production, regrouped on how they're gonna wrap up the series. And they, because really the show is also winding down even before the allegations came out.
It seems like in this climate, though, people are forced to hate the whole thing, kitchen sink and all. But I wonder how long that will last. So it's... The Woody Allen effect has never seemed to cause any problems for him.
I think this may be the turning of the tide, though. His last movie tanked.
Well, maybe it wasn't a good movie.
Well, it wasn't
I don't know.
But I will be shocked because he makes a movie literally every year. And we have like the current stars of his movie, his next movie, saying that they are donating the fee that they got from it to organizations because they don't want to take his money anymore.
Yeah, I think... eventually time just dulls all this out.
I mean, you say that, but this has been a constant conversation since at least, what, October, when the first story about Harvey Weinstein
out? It's still very fresh, if you will. And historically, there's tons of artists who are monsters, but their work is cherished now, like Picasso, for example. So it almost seems like as time goes by, it softens it dulls it down. And this is a very old debate about hating the artist or the art or both simultaneously. It just comes down to bad behavior and how people want to deal with it. And I think right now there's so much of a tripwire around people and people's anger that they'll hate anything that they can in front of them. It's just a really complicated thing when it comes to people that do these like crazy and awful things. But you see, or you have seen, like real genius in the art that they had done before you even knew about that. It's a really weird topic to really go deep on. We see even more hypocrisy at the table, our gang's table. So Howard Bellwether finishes up his speech. Ted, Melanie, and Lindsay stand to applaud Howard Bellwether. Everybody else in the venue is standing to applaud him, including Ted, Melanie, and Lindsay. Emmett, Debbie, and Vic stay seated and give the dour looks about it. So I could see Ted standing up because he already had that mental argument of hate the artist, love the art. But Melanie and Lindsay didn't really make sense. I don't know why they were applauding Howard Bellwether other than the fact that they were like on the committee.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking that it was only tied to the fact they were on the committee and they were just showing face or something. They're like in solidarity with the committee, maybe?
Yeah, I thought it was a curious directorial choice there about who stood and who didn't stand. Why wasn't Michael there for this? This was Brian, his best friend, receiving an award. Granted, he's at the Comic-Con, but...
But wasn't this after he had had that huge blowout with him? And so maybe he was doing it and I don't want to be... If Michael's not... Or if Brian is not going to support me, why would I support him right now?
Yeah, I could see that. This was like a $300 plate dinner. So surely they had to buy tickets in advance for it.
And I'm sure Michael doesn't have the $300
to... I think he did because he chose to go to Comic-Con. Like the 3 day of comic overload, that had to have been pretty expensive.
Well, that was 3 days. This was one dinner.
That's true. He does work at the Big Q. Okay, so that's about everything that went on in this episode. Let's do our scorecard and wrap this up. So for timeliness, I'm going to give this one 4 out of 5. Hypocrisy is something that is overwhelming the country right now in 2018. Though this was a lightweight story of various hypocrisies, it struck me as being very relevant to us 17 years later. Information accuracy, I gave it 3 out of 5, mostly because of the barebacking story elements. For better or worse, barebacking isn't as deadly as it used to be. In this episode, it was held up as an absolute no-no, hypocritical act of the great Howard Bellwether. So the information was a little off there. It doesn't seem like these days it would have been a big deal at all to see Howard fucking that bottom. We never saw the bottom, did we?
No.
We don't know what he was fucking. Relatability. I gave it 3 out of 5 because I felt like Michael's story was pretty tired. I don't relate to those festering problem stories that just kind of drag out through a whole episode. I like it when characters aggressively go after their problems and make a little mess as they go, as they try to solve them. So I thought Michael's story was just a little weak, just didn't really tip the needle for me here.
In terms of my scorecard, it's pretty much 1 for 1 here. 4 on timeliness, 3 on accuracy, 3 on relatability. I have a couple of different reasons, though. I think mainly my thing with the relatability is that I think while we are definitely calling out the hypocrisy, I think that's very prevalent, obviously, as you said, with timeliness. There's the issue with how we are representing the gay community, or those that we choose to show as representatives of the gay community, that I'm having a huge issue with. Like, they wanted to have, like in Howard Bellwether, they wanted their clean cut, untouchable, has done no wrong gay man. And I think we're moving towards where we are starting to recognize people for their flaws. And in some ways, we are rewarding those flaws because they're shown as human, if that makes any sense. Yeah. And in terms of the accuracy, absolutely. I think the barebacking party really solidified the dated nature of this. While I think there are definitely parties that are... I don't want to say dangerous, but...
dangerous. Risky.
Riskier, yes.
Consensual risk.
Yes. It's the judgment that's put onto it that has... You know, there's still some of that internal debate that we have in the community. There are people who are 100% against it, no matter what relationship status you might be. And then there are those that are taking on more consensual risk, but it's almost like they're living a... It's like there's a sexual revolution again. And so I think seeing it now 17 years later and watching that debate now really starts to remove where the, like how the series is sort of really settled in its time.
This was episode 3 of season 2 entitled Hypocrisy. Don't do it.
Next week, we'll cover episode 4, Pride.
That's my least favorite episode.
You have no pride, do you, Patrick?
We'll talk about that next week. If you listened this far, thank you. We really appreciate it. Click that subscribe button. It really means a lot to us.
And make sure you like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, Still Queer as Folk. And until then, I'm Matt Dominguez.
And I'm Patrick Randall. We'll see you next week. Still Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.